Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Bob Enyart. Just an hour ago, I received an email from a pastor in Ohio, Pastor George Craig, also a homeschool dad. And he wrote, "Dear Bob, your recent two-part interview with Dr. Rob Carter hit it out of the park. Fabulous content. My confidence in God has been strengthened as I see the many evidences of his handiwork. I've watched Dr. Carter's DVD on Mitochondrial Eve several times." I got to agree, I watched it several times too. And now I'm on my second time through of the latest DVD from CMI, Creation Ministries International. That's Evolution's Achilles Heels, which we talked to Rob Carter on. And as promised, during that interview, we said that we would be doing a follow-up. And so what an honor to welcome back to Real Science Radio, Dr. Rob Carter. Hello, Rob.
Hello. The honor is all mine.
Well, thank you. Rob Carter is a biologist who earned his PhD studying genetics at the University of Miami. Rob, do I have it right when I've told others that you have earned a place in the history of science by working to publish for our mitochondrial DNA a consensus sequence?
I suppose a small part in the pantheon of science, yeah. I mean,
well, to me, it's our mitochondrial DNA has 16,000 base pairs, and we've learned so much from it, the Y chromosome and the X chromosome. And so as you and I mentioned, we could now discuss what genetics is telling us as we consider the world from the context of Genesis.
Genetics tells us an unbelievable number of things that fit with the Genesis narrative.
I just reviewed your fabulous DVD on Noah's daughters and mitochondrial Eve. But where would you like to start?
Well, let's start with Eve. Let's start with the mitochondrial DNA. Let's start with the mother of us all.
Okay. That's what we read in Genesis chapter 3, verse 20. Eve is the mother of us all. So mitochondrial DNA, it's not in our nucleus, right?
That's right. It's still inside your cells, but not in the nucleus. Every cell has a couple of hundred mitochondria, and each one of those has one chromosome of about 16,500 letters.
Okay, whereas the DNA in our nucleus has about 3 billion base pairs letters.
6 billion, because you have two copies of the genome in each cell.
Wow, what a great point. So
you have about 6 feet of DNA in every cell.
Our mitochondrial DNA, is it duplicated? The 16,000 base pairs?
Yeah, it's in multiple copies because you have multiple mitochondria, and they duplicate themselves. They divide.
All right, so what is mitochondrial DNA telling us about our origins?
First, we have to get a little bit of experimental work out of the way. A lot of experimental work has been done on this, and from all that work, it looks like you only inherit your mitochondria from your mother. Now, because of that, what happens is that when a mutation occurs in a person, that mutation is unique to that person and all of that woman's descendants. And so if we look around the world today, we can build a family tree of the female side of all the people in the world, going back to however many ancestresses there were. And it turns out everything goes back to a single woman who lived in the fairly recent past.
Who lived in the fairly recent past. In part, we can say that because of our mitochondrial DNA and how consistent it is, the integrity of that.
Yeah, how similar it is from one person to another across the entire world. They're incredibly similar to one another. Hmm. It would not take long, even in an evolutionary world, it would not take long to build up the number of differences that we see from one person to the next.
Could we talk about, you put in a little clarification. Normally, people just assert that we get our mitochondrial DNA from our mother. You put a little clarification in that. If we think of when we've seen in anatomy, biology, a woman's ova, an ovum, and a sperm cell, the sperm cell is tiny compared to the ova.
And, but the sperm cell has lots of mitochondria because it needs lots of energy. And they're at the head of it, the front of it. There is a potential for the father contributing mitochondria. And there are some controversial papers out there that say in humans it looks like it happens, and other people try to retract those papers. So there's a little bit of an argument going on. In other species, we know that the father can contribute mitochondria.
So that, generally speaking, we do get our mitochondrial DNA from our mother, but there is possibility that in some instances it may come from the father.
Yeah, and it's usually not a big deal. Unless the father and mother have very different strains of mitochondria, mm-hmm. because then there's a potential of mitochondrial recombination, where the chromosomes of two mitochondria can recombine, and if that happens, you can't build a nice family tree.
Oh, wow.
Because you just cross two branches.
Right, right.
So the whole argument relies on purely maternal inheritance, no recombination.
So when we look at the degree of difference, could you give us an idea of the degree of difference? You said as we look around the world, we find primarily similar sequence, but how much difference might there be, or is there?
On average, take two random people from anywhere outside of Africa, from one end of the world to the other. They're on average about 30 to 40 letters different, sometimes a lot less. Sometimes one, sometimes they're identical, and sometimes up to 40. If you include some people from Africa, most Africans actually fit with the worldwide average, but the Khoisan Bushmen of Southern Africa, you know, those people that have an awesome language that has clicks in it.
Yeah.
The Biaka Pygmies, they might not like to be called that anymore, but the short people that live in the rainforests of Cameroon and places like that.
All right.
Those two groups tend to have very dissimilar mitochondria. And they're up to 100 letters difference from everyone else in the world.
Wow.
Out of 16,569, that's a small percentage of differences.
Mm-hmm. So then, as we continue the story, our mitochondrial DNA has an astounding amount of similarity. I know that when the secular scientific community, they want to come up with a date for mitochondrial Eve, and they have had within their own writings controversy.
Oh, yeah.
Because they like to include chimp DNA, chimp mitochondria, in order to make it look older, because then it's circular reasoning and they include their own assumptions. But when they look at actual mutation rates, documented mutation rates, mitochondrial Eve was far more recent than they're comfortable talking about.
Yes, and this is a known controversy amongst the evolutionists. They know the issue and they write about it. We have two different rates. We have a phylogenetic rate that assumes evolutionary history, and then we have a genealogical rate, where if you look at a family tree and count up the differences of the people and divide by the number of generations, you get a rate per generation or rate per year. And the genealogical rate is orders of magnitude faster. So the rate we can actually measure is orders of magnitude faster than the evolutionary assumption would have it.
And so that's what led a famous science reporter, Ann Gibbons, she was writing in Science, the journal Science, yeah. an article called Calibrating the Mitochondrial Clock. And even though she doesn't believe this, this is what she wrote, quote, mitochondrial Eve would be a mere 6,000 years old. And that is if you're taking the actual measured mutation rates and applying them.
That was an old paper. A lot of work has been done since then that basically right. says the same thing. In fact, the latest paper that I've seen, some scientists were looking at a family in Costa Rica with a deep genealogy, and they looked at only one little portion of the mitochondrial genome. They figured out how many mutations they found. Well, I took that and multiplied it by the whole mitochondrial genome, and when you do that, it comes out to about one mutation every other generation. You know, the 100 mutations that separate the most distant people alive today could happen in 200 generations, which is almost exactly 6,000 years.
Wow.
It doesn't even have to be that number. It could have been anywhere within an order of magnitude, anywhere in the general range I would be totally happy with.
Right.
If you look at the people, like most of the other people alive today, I'm saying from one person to the next, well, that's not to our common ancestors. That's from living people. Go back to Eve. Most people are about 22 mutations away from Eve. At that rate, that's only 44 generations.
Oh, my.
That's after Christ. Using that mutation rate, that's the common ancestor of almost everyone in the world. Mm. That's great. So we have got room to spare. The numbers are actually on our side of the argument.
Yeah, that's rather thrilling. And so that's the discussion of the mitochondrial DNA. Then there is the Y chromosome and someone called Y chromosomal Adam. And the history of Y chromosomal Adam is extraordinarily encouraging for the biblical creationist.
And getting better. In college, I was taught the Y chromosome is a vestigial piece of junk DNA. It's all shriveled up, hardly has any genes on it, and one day it'll just be deleted entirely.
Right.
Yeah, well, they know a lot better now, because if we know it's a master control switch that affects thousands of other genes and other chromosomes. But also, just like the mitochondrial DNA, the Y chromosome is only inherited from one parent, of course. So you can look at all the men in the world and build a family tree of just the paternal side of just the Y chromosome, and it is incredibly encouraging.
I recall the first time, I think it was the first time, that Y chromosomes from around the world were sequenced, at least parts of them. The study was prepared. There was a shock in that they weren't able to find differences. Am I remembering that correctly?
That is true. That was one of the earlier studies and one of the places that they looked at. And it was very frustrating for them, and they did some magic math and came up with a date. I don't know how you can get a date for zero differences, but they had a date. Since then, they've done a lot of work on Y chromosomes. There's tons and tons of sequences out there, not many full sequences, but
right. They
will look at places that they know are variable, and they'll sequence a whole bunch of different men. And when you do that, you can account for all the diversity in Y chromosomes we see in men alive today. Again, if there's one mutation per generation, you can explain everybody since Adam. With room to spare.
Oh, my.
It's just amazing. It didn't have to be that way. If there was a whole lot of diversity, the evolutionists might have a better argument. But we don't have to appeal to any sort of God miraculously added things, or mutation rates are much faster in the past than they are today. No, we can just say, look, looking at it around today, experimental science, take experimental science today, backtrack a few thousand years, boom, you're done. There's Adam.
On Real Science Radio, Fred Williams and I, we have been monitoring articles as they come out, looking at the mutations in Europe, for example, or in different regions around the world. And there's a theme. And the theme is this. The secular researchers will say we can account for almost all the genetic diversity simply in the course of known human history.
Most variation is recent. Evolutionists will just say it up front. Most all the variation is recent. And the reason that's true is because they think we came out of Africa. I think we came out of Babel. But both sides say there's a single dispersion of people across the planet. And when you find something that's only found in a fraction of a percent of people, like blue eyes, red hair, sickle cell anemia, those things, because they're only found in one place of the world, they have to have happened after the dispersion, or you'd find them in multiple places in the world.
Wow.
And most of the variation is rare and recent. And so the evolutionists sitting there scratching their heads saying, wow, that's a lot of variation we're finding. But if you get rid of all that and you look at what is shared across the world, that's the stuff that was in Adam.
I was getting
a little ahead of myself. There's approximately 10 million variations that are found in all people groups in the world. And on top of that, there are 10 or 20, we don't even know how many, millions of rare mutations that are brand new. And that includes deletions. There's every person alive, as far as we can measure, is missing about a million letters of DNA.
Hmm.
The reason they're not dead is because if they got something that's missing from mom, they got a good copy from dad.
Hmm.
But these deletions are very specific to different areas of the world. So the deletions themselves are recent. And it's surprising because a lot of these deletions, their entire genes missing. How can a species survive over time if genes are being deleted by accident and that deletion is being passed on through history?
So therefore, if this had been going on for millions of years, we see the tendency is to lose genetic information, not to build up from a bacteria to a human genome.
Yes.
But to
and
lose.
Because there's two copies of the genome, there's redundancy. Redundancy is a brilliant design aspect of the genome. That's why the space shuttle, every critical component, there was three of them. So if one of them broke, they still had a backup to the backup.
Wow.
Well, redundancy in the genome is a brilliant design aspect. The reason that we can survive all those deletions is we have two copies of everything. If we didn't have two copies, we would already be extinct.
Oh, my. So God, as the creator, designer, the engineer, he built robustness into the human organism, in fact, into all organisms.
Yes.
And so we are astoundingly robust. And as we talked about in our last interview, and we're speaking with Dr. Rob Carter of Creation Ministries International, I highly recommend their new DVD and book, Evolution's Achilles Heels. The redundancy is one aspect of the brilliance of the design. There is brilliance in every perspective, every way we look at the DNA, and the secular scientists who remain in awe at the increasing awareness of the sophistication of the genome.
Yeah, everywhere we look. The complexity of the cell, the more complex it becomes, the less tenable Darwinian evolution is.
Mm.
Darwin needs it to be simple, and it's not. And history is not simple. And history of the genome is not simple. It's so complex, and it's so fun to study. It's an amazing. It's just begging us to get there, get into it, and explore. Because as we explore it, not only do we learn about the brilliance of God, but we can see the history of the Bible unfolding before our eyes.
I will be interviewing within a week or so Dr. Richard Sternberg, who worked at the Smithsonian. You probably are aware.
Oh, yeah.
I was on a fossil dig with him and his son up in Montana years ago. And Ben Stein's movie Expelled, they talk about him being expelled from the Smithsonian.
Yeah.
But he likes to talk about leading evolutionary scientists who are so mad at the ENCODE project, where hundreds of secular researchers, really thousands, are finding evidence of function of the DNA in the most wildly sophisticated ways. And there are scientists, evolutionists, who are angry at that, and they want to close down the ENCODE project because it, in fact, one has famously said, if ENCODE is true, then evolution is false.
Yes. Now, that quote, the person who said that was trying his hardest to rebut the ENCODE project.
Right.
So he's the one saying, I believe ENCODE. Let's say it this way. ENCODE has revealed that a whole lot of the genome is functional. But you know, that doesn't even matter. All we have to do is get the level of function above what the Darwinists can handle.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be 90% functional. It doesn't have to be 50% functional. It doesn't have to be 20% functional. They like their functionality down around the 2% level.
Right.
If it's above 2%, they're in trouble. It's above 10%, they're doomed. It's above 20%, there's no way in the history of the universe they're going to be able to explain how that came to be.
Yeah. Yeah.
On how evolution maintains it, how natural selection can purify it.
Right.
So ENCODE is wonderful. Wonderful. But, I mean, even from my perspective, I don't require the entire genome to be functional.
Right.
I know there are broken things. I know there's some redundancy in there. There
sure.
might be something that's just there because there are parts of the genome that are there to hold a three-dimensional structure.
Right. A structural.
Therefore, the sequence is irrelevant. It's just the pieces there because it holds that gene there and this gene over here. So it's got a structural function, but not sequence-wise.
Right. So a structural function may be different from an informational
yes.
function, but
yes.
it's still a function. It's still important.
Absolutely.
If it weren't there, it would break somehow.
Absolutely. So even if, you know, they're going to argue back and forth about ENCODE for a long time, even if they get to the point where, okay, well, ENCODE, they said too much, it's really this level. Whatever level it is, it's still higher than evolutionary mathematics can handle.
Mm.
And that's the fun part about it.
So, Rob, from your DVD on Noah's daughters-in-law and mitochondrial DNA.
Mitochondrial Eve and the Three Daughters of Noah. That's the title of the
yes.
DVD.
Yes. What a fabulous DVD. So God created Adam and Eve. So originally, at most, there would have been, well, how many variations of each gene? How many alleles? There would have been four at most, right? Because you pointed out we have two copies.
It depends on several things. Since Eve was pulled out of Adam's side, she might be a near clone of Adam.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning if Adam had two chromosomes, Eve had the same two chromosomes, and at any point in the genome, there can only be two letters or two variations.
Right.
If Eve was not a clone, then she's got two original genomes, and he's got two original genomes. At any point in the genome, there could be four variations. But there's something I thought of, I think, after I made that DVD, and that is, God could have put any amount of diversity he wanted in Adam and Eve's reproductive cells.
Oh, wow. What a great point.
So we could have an unlimited amount of diversity in those first several generations, depending on how many children they had.
Right. Now, Adam would be producing his gametes. So it would be within Eve's ovaries, probably, that diversity could have been preloaded.
Yes, but Adam could have had multiple sperm primogenia cells. For spermatogonia, they were called. It's been a long time since I studied that in biology.
Yeah.
He could have multiple different versions, so they could be producing different genomes in his reproductive cells.
Wow.
Okay. But we don't need any of that. When we look around the world today and we look at the diversity of people, and if you get rid of all the rare stuff that we know is new, just statistically, all that stuff should be new, and look at all the common stuff, there are about 10 million variations that are found in all people groups around the world, and any individual carries, on average, about 3 million of them. Well, those aren't disease-causing mutations. In fact, I don't even think they're mutations. I think it's created diversity. I think that's what God put into Adam. Mm. If God just puts in 10 million variants into Adam, makes Eve a clone if he wants to, then everything else after that can be explained.
Wow.
It's not that big a deal. And it, man, when we realized that, we just sat back and said, this is amazing. This is not supposed to be true. This is supposed to be hard to answer.
Right.
We haven't talked about dating yet.
All right.
How do you get a date for mitochondrial Eve or a date for Y chromosome Adam? Those are excellent questions. The evolutionist is not going to look at real world mutation rates. Because then we had the Ann Gibbons problem. We have the fact that Adam and Eve would have been too recent. Mm. They're going to look at, well, here's a chimpanzee mitochondrial genome. Here's a human mitochondrial genome. There's X number of thousands of differences. And divide by that 6 million years.
Right.
And you get a very small number. Because any number divided by 6 million is going to be a small number. Mm. That's your mutation rate. Now, looking at the people today, at that mutation rate, Eve would have lived 380,000 years ago. Or worse, they say, when people got to the Americas from Siberia, it was X number of thousand years ago. And if we look at the diversity of Native Americans divided by that many thousands of years, then we get a mutation rate for modern people. And that sounds a little better because we're not appealing to 6 million years. But man, the date for the peopling of the Americas, I mean, how speculative can you get? And that's one way they calibrate. So you can calibrate to phylogeny, you can calibrate to archaeology. You can calibrate to any number of things, but none of those are actually using measurable mutation rates.
So the creationists shine when the geneticists use measurable mutation rates.
Absolutely.
And it points right to the historicity of the book of Genesis. And we have also the X chromosome, and we have the Tower of Babel. So we've been sort of talking around these issues. Genesis says that at the Tower of Babel, that God confused the languages and caused man to disperse across the face of the earth.
It does say that. We see a lot of confirmation in this. If you just look at the out of Africa model, they say that a man evolved in Africa over a long period of time. We went through this big bottleneck where we nearly went extinct. That's where modern man evolved. And then we started increasing in numbers and we escaped Africa. But as soon as we leave Africa, everything else they say after that is a Tower of Babel story. They say there's been a single dispersion of people across the planet in a fairly recent past with limited genetic diversity in small people groups with only a few mitochondrial lineages. That is screaming Tower of Babel. So why do they put their starting point in Africa? Because they have to. They don't know it's in Africa. It's a statistical argument.
It's too close to the Bible to say it was in Mesopotamia.
Yeah, they can't say that.
It's too uncomfortable. You've pointed out that the diversity in Babel is not all that less than the diversity in Africa. Is that correct?
The diversity of the Middle East, of the Southwest Asia, is not that much less than Northeast Africa.
Wow.
In fact, if you're in Africa, if you go west in Africa, genetic diversity goes down. If you go south in Africa, genetic diversity goes down. It's as if Africa was filled up by people from the Northeast. Oh, wait a minute. That's exactly where they would come from if Babel was true. Since the Bible doesn't talk about people from sub-Saharan Africa, it talks about, Egypt and Ethiopia. But south of that, we know nothing about where those people came from. All you have to do is have a couple of more people groups get to Africa than get to Asia. And now all of a sudden you have more diversity in Africa and the whole puzzle is explained.
So, as you conclude, modern genetics has rediscovered Genesis, the main outline of Genesis, including creation, the genetic bottleneck of the global flood and the 8 people on the ark, and then the Tower of Babel. It's all thrilling. Dr. Carter, to give our audience a scoop, I believe that you have an upcoming article on a different topic with Dr. Sarfati. Can we mention that or no?
Well, it's still in draft stage. We've been writing an article trying to refute geocentrism.
Yes, which keeps rearing its head.
It sure does. But yeah, with a recent documentary that was produced, it ensnared one of our speakers.
Ah, so we will be looking forward to that article on geokinetics, the evidence that the Earth moves.
Right, and it should be on creation.com sometime in the future.
All right, that creation.com. And then again, the DVD and the book, Evolution's Achilles Heels. Dr. Rob Carter is the editor and producer. Rob, what a thrill to talk to you again. Thank you so very much.
You're very, very welcome. It's my pleasure.
Okay, that's Dr. Rob Carter with Creation Ministries International, CMI. Their flagship publication is Creation Magazine, which we strongly recommend. Also, Dr. Carter's books on Mitochondrial Eve and the Three Daughters of Noah, then Evolution's Achilles Heels. This is Bob Enyart for Fred Williams and Real Science Radio. Our website, realscienceradio.com. Realscienceradio.com. Now you could abbreviate that, rsr.org. And when you go there, of course, we have on the top of the website in the right column all our classic list shows. Real Science Radio's list of not so old things. Real Science Radio's list of genomes that just don't fit. Real Science Radio's list of Big Bang predictions, which is just a stunning program and article. Real Science Radio's list of evidence against the Big Bang. But at the top of the website, if you click on store, if you click on our store, you click on the science department, there are so many neat resources that I think you'll just absolutely love. And if you'd like to help us to continue to broadcast and reach more and more people, then you could consider making a donation one time or monthly, and you could consider subscribing to our monthly DVDs, our monthly Bible studies. We have so many resources that we've been building up for many years, and our effort is, if we can't create the best available, we'll find it for you. And so it's all there online, realscienceradio.com. That's an alias, URL redirect. It goes to our kgov.com website, where we do Bob Enyart Live throughout the week, Monday through Thursday. So this is Bob Enyart for Real Science Radio. May God bless you.
Talking about.